Our next speaker is Anil Bhushan from UCLA. Anil has really been one of the leaders in the field of beta cell replication, and today he's going to tell us about whether he thinks beta cells, in fact, ever do replicate, particularly in the adult.
Well, with the previous talks, we had a wonderful introduction, so I don't know, I can jump right into the data. It's a little nostalgic to come back and give a talk at the SALT because I did my postdoc here, and a lot of things have changed, but a lot of things haven't changed. Let me just sort of tell you how beta cells come about during in the adult, and the first step is during embryogenesis that Jim Wells talks about, which is that the pancreatic progenitor cells or stem cells will differentiate into beta cells. And so all the beta cells that arise during embryogenesis come from this differentiation process. Right at the end of embryogenesis and in the early neonatal phases is when you have a huge burst of proliferation of the existing beta cells. And that's what really leads to the what we call the beta cell mass in the adult. And then there's a sharp drop-off in mice. This happens around 2 months where these beta cells that proliferate rapidly in the neonatal phases right after birth, then now there's very little proliferation, and the beta cell mass is more or less maintained with very little input from proliferation. So what I wanted to focus on is both a little bit on this differentiation process during embryogenesis and the mechanisms that lead to this transition of beta cell proliferation that rapidly decreases with age. Now, what you've heard a bit about, and this is a slide that represents, as Jim was talking about, this represents hundreds of labs doing this work. But the point I want to make with the slide is primarily that when we talk about cell lineage fate within the pancreas, within the especially within the endoderm, not the endoderm, I mean the within the islet cell types, you'll see it's mostly what we know is these are transcription factors, and the lineage of how you get to a beta cell is really what sort of transcription factors mark various stages leading to beta cell differentiation. And obviously this development biology has been used by what Anne Bang will talk about in the next talk is they've used this sort of development biology principles to direct embryonic cell differentiation of embryonic stem cells to a beta cell type of cells. And then again, most of what you see here, how people analyze, is based on transcription factors. And sort of our lab has taken this approach that what we're really missing in this thing is that we really don't know the underlying epigenetic mechanisms that regulate this cell fate transitions and cell fate specifications. And I'll just tell you a little bit of what's happening in the lab in two different stories. First is one sort of epigenetic mechanism that's quite prevalent is the modification of DNA methylation. And DNA methylation is typically involved in gene silencing, and the role of gene silencing in cell fate specification is really not well known. DNA methylation is regulated by molecules of known as DNMTs or DNA methyltransferases, and there's sort of two kinds. There's one called the de novo methylations, which are DNA DNMT 3A and 3Bs, and this leads to de novo methylation, which is then maintained by DNMT 1, which is a DNA methylase maintenance methylase. Now, the work that I'll talk about is primarily done by a postdoc in the lab, Sangeeta Dhawan and Shenning. Now, DNMT3A, which is one of the de novo methylases, is primarily expressed in beta cells. It's very strongly expressed in beta cells throughout embryogenesis as well as into the early neonatal stages. And it has a very striking phenotype when you knock it out. So this is DNMT3A knocked out with a specifically in beta cells. So once beta cells differentiate and you knock out de novo methylase, you end up getting a lot more, a lot fewer beta cells and a lot more alpha cells. And you can quantify that, but I don't want to show all this. But basically, if you do lineage tracing, which is mentioned before, Jim mentioned it, if you lineage trace the beta cells, essentially what it shows is that the beta cells actually convert into alpha cells. So what this means is that there is some sort of de novo methylation that is required to maintain the beta cell fate. And as I mentioned, in terms of the other, the DNMT1, which is a methylase that maintains the DNA methylation, if you knock that out again in the beta cells, you see, again, the same phenotype with a lot more alpha cells compared to beta cells. So the hypothesis in the model here is that there is an active de novo methylation occurring in beta cells that is required to maintain beta cell fate. And this essentially means is that there are a certain group of genes that are being actively silenced or repressed by DNA methylation. And in its absence, when these genes now become transcriptionally active, that the beta cell fate converts to an alpha cell fate. Now, we did what's called a global analysis of it, what we call a chip-on-chip analysis, a MEDIP, of methylation genes. Since the tissues we're dealing with is so low, we use models for cell lines for beta cells and alpha cells. And basically, there's a lot of genes we picked out that are specifically repressed in beta cells, and in its absence, they would become alpha cells. So I just wanted to give you a flavor of this, but I really wanted to focus on in this talk is how you transition. Once you get a beta cell, the most of the beta cells that come in that are produced in the animal that give rise to the beta cell mass is this active proliferation. But then you have this rapid decline of proliferation that leads to a beta cell that does not proliferate very well. And if you want to regenerate the beta cell mass, you really need to understand how to reverse this process. Now, the reason we came about this experiment where it's a very simple experiment. If you take young and old mice and you treat them with a high-fat diet to make them insulin resistant, what normally happens is there's something called an adaptive expansion of beta cells to compensate for the insulin resistance. And this is just to show you that the experiment works in terms of a high-fat diet, that the mice actually become insulin resistant. But the surprising thing is that the young mice don't become diabetic, while the old mice become diabetic after an 8-week high-fat diet. And the primary reason for them to become is that the young mice have this capacity to expand their beta cell mass, while the old mice don't have this capacity and do not expand their beta cell mass and hence become diabetic. Now, so what's the sort of mechanism of why this is happening? You can look at it another way. You can do it a number of ways when you can take young and old mice and you can give them GLP-1, you can do lots of other things. Here's another experiment where it's a regeneration experiment where you inject the mice with a beta cell toxin called streptozoidin, and the STZ mice in young mice then have a greater number of beta cells that proliferate after STZ treatment, while the old mice don't have the capacity to proliferate, to regenerate and proliferate to STZ. So we were interested in what really led to the mechanisms of why beta cells go through this transition where they can't regenerate when they're older, and that really affects this whole issue of regeneration in older people, which would be more therapeutic for most reasons. To look for this, we looked at certain genes that would decrease their expression during age, and one of them is a group of genes called the polycomb group of genes. One of them is BMI1, which is expressed primarily in the beta cells and ductal cells in young mice, but as the mice ages, the expression declines. And this expression of BMI1 decline is mirrored by increase in expression of a locus that we think BMI1 regulates, which is called the INF4ARF locus, which has two genes that are produced from this locus, the INF4A, or otherwise known as P16, and ARF, which is otherwise known as P19. So BMI1 levels decrease, INF4A and ARF levels go up. Now, to show more definitively that BMI1 actually regulates this locus, here's we looked at the knockouts of BMI1. Basically, in BMI1 knockouts, again, you see increased levels of both INF4A and ARF in the absence of BMI1, and you can do that in terms of RNA as well as in protein. And what's interesting and surprising is that in the BMI1, in normal wild-type mice, as I mentioned, the proliferation of beta cells decreases as they age, and the same thing now, and it's more pronounced in the BMI1 knockouts when you have hardly any proliferation of beta cells with increased amounts of P16 and P19. I should mention that P16 works in the cell cycle and represses cyclin D CDK4 complex, so it is an inhibitor of the cell cycle. So again, in the BMI1 knockouts, you have very, as expected, the islets are extremely small, and as a consequence of small islets, the beta cell mass is greatly decreased, and when you don't have enough beta cell mass, these mice have the inability to metabolize glucose because of very little serum insulin there. So what was the mechanism of how BMI1, which is this polycomb gene, regulating the INF4ARF locus? And I just give you a little background on histone modifications. So polycombs come in two complexes. The PRC1 complex contains BMI1 and RING1, and this complex has the activity to modify a H2A, histone on H2A, to ubiquitinate H2A. And PRC2 contains EZH2, which is a histone methyl transferase that modifies H3K27 and trimethylates it. So here's the INF4ARF locus, and these are the primers that we'll be talking about throughout the locus that represent what modifications occur. The first thing I want to point out that to show BMI1 does bind to this locus, as does EZH2. Now, in the absence of BMI1, the BMI1 knockouts, obviously you don't have BMI1 binding, but you also don't have H2A ubiquitination that's associated with the activity of BMI1. But surprisingly, you do have binding of EZH2 and H3K27 methylation. And this is sort of interesting because this was until now recently thought to be, this is the typically the repressive mark that sort of marks the repression of this locus. And then the fact is that in the BMI1 knockouts, this locus is derepressed, and yet you have this repressive mark still sitting on there. So what's the role of EZH2? If you knock down EZH2, you also knock down H2A ubiquitination, and you lose BMI1 binding. So the model here then becomes is that EZH2 containing PRC2 complex first binds to this locus and leads to the modification of H3K27, which then attracts the PRC1 complex, which then leads to ubiquitination, which then leads to the repression of this locus. Basically, having H3K27 is not sufficient to repress it, and basically you need to attract the BMI1 complex and lead to ubiquitination. Now, during aging, the same process occurs that we found in the BMI1 knockouts. That is, in old mice, you have very little BMI1 binding, you have very little EZH2 binding, and consequently, you have very little H2 ubiquitination and H3K27 methylation. And you can actually see this in immunohistochemistry, where you see in young mice, you have very high levels of H2A ubiquitination within the islet, and as the mouse ages, the islets, you lose the H2A ubiquitination, which marks the activation of this locus. So what this explains, the Inc4RF locus, is the polycomb genes are clearly repressed, you know, they repress this locus, but in the absence of BMI1, you still have increased, with aging, increased levels of Inc4A and ARF with aging. So clearly, just the absence of polycomb genes does not explain why the Inc4RF locus increases with aging. And to do that, we sort of looked in and correlated what's called another mark, which is the activating mark, which is H3K4 trimethylation. And basically, when H2A ubiquination is decreased in old mice, H3K4 methylation is increased. And the same thing happens in the BMI1 knockout mice as well. You have decreased amounts of H2A ubiquination with increased amounts of H3K4 methylation. There's something there that was activating and leading to this activation of H3K4 that really explained the increase of the Inc4RF locus with age. And to cut the long story short, we identified another group of genes called the trithorax group of genes that bind the primary member of this trithorax group, which is MLL1, which binds to this locus and leads to H3K4 methylation, which then leads to activation of in young and old, as well as in BMI1 knockout. It's the same issue. And just to make the story simple, it's the idea is that polycomb genes are repressive, you know, lead to repressive marks on the Inc4RF locus, and it's the trithorax genes that lead to the activation marks. And in simple analogies, this would represent the brake on the system, and that would repress it. Well, this would be the accelerator to actually make the thing go. And this is a complete new concept, and I'll try to get back to why this is important for regeneration. If, as I mentioned, when you treat mice with a beta toxin, SDZ, there's a spontaneous regeneration that occurs, and this is primarily driven by beta cell proliferation. And if you look at mice that have that have been treated with SDZ, you see now increased expression of BMI1, and most of these cells coincide with proliferating cells, so the marker for Ki67. Basically, most of the proliferating cells express BMI1 during regeneration. And you can actually look at the regenerating islet, and you can see that during regeneration, H2A ubiquination is now up. There's a lot more beta cells that have H2A ubiquination compared to a wild type, and you have decreased amounts of P16. So basically, the mechanism of what leads to aging, that is the de-repression of the Inc4RF locus, that leads to where making beta cells not proliferate. During regeneration, this process is reversed, and again, it's regulated by polycomb genes, as well as the leading to the regulation of the Inc4RF locus. So here's the model of how the Inc4RF locus is regulated, and basically, during aging, in young cells, polycomb genes are bound to the locus that keep this locus repressed. But as the beta cell ages, you have polycomb genes that now are dissociated from this locus. And once they dissociate, you have the binding of the trithorax genes, which then lead to activation of this locus, leading to expression of P16, and P16 essentially means that the beta cell is no longer capable of proliferating and regenerating. But as most of you have followed this literature in the last year, this has been a big revelation, is that these histone marks are not permanent and that they're very dynamic. And what our regeneration experiments show is that these marks are very dynamic, and there are actual demethylases and deubiquitinases that lead to removal of these marks. And we've, you know, looked at which JMJD3, which is a demethylase that is specific for H3K27, and UPS21, which is a deubiquitinase that is specific for H2AUB, and these are the ones that are in the beta cell. Basically, what you would predict and what happens in the beta cell is JMJD, if you knock down JMJD3, you now you get increased amounts of H3K27 ubiquination, and if you knock down UPS21, you have increased amounts of H2A ubiquination. So these become tools to dynamically modify the histone marks that actually then can be used in regeneration of beta cells. So I come back to this slide because Anne Bank's going to follow me, but to show that what we hope to do in our research really is to fill in what's sort of missing here in terms of transcription factors, but also to fill in what sort of epigenetic factors here are regulating this transitions from an embryonic stem cell to a beta cell, as well as once a beta cell forms, how to make sort of an old beta cell, a young beta cell, sort of rejuvenation, which sounds a bit hokey, but you can actually, if you use this epigenetic mechanisms both ways to either make new beta cells or to make old beta cells young, we could sort of promote regeneration and make more beta cells. So I just want to thank Goping Fang, who's a colleague at UCLA, who's collaborating with me in the DNMT's project. Peter Butler, who's the division chief of UCLA and a mentor. Funding from BCBC and IDDK, JDRF, and Larry Hoodlum Foundation. And this is a portion of my lab because there's no photograph. But the people who really did the work that I mentioned before were Sangeeta and Shenning. Thanks.